This is Positive Parenting. Parenting expertise and advice from best-selling parenting author and national newspaper columnist, Mr. Dad, Armin Brott.
Hey there, this is Positive Parenting, and I'm Armin Brott. Many kids with autism have trouble recognizing social cues, which makes them awkward around others. They also may engage in repetitive behaviors and tend to be hypersensitive to environmental stimuli. And all of that can make kids with developmental disabilities and autism ripe targets for bullies who have a tendency to hone in on differences, and they really enjoy aggravating their victims. So it's really no small wonder that a fairly recent study found that children with autism spectrum disorders are bullied far more often than their typically developing peers, 5 times as often, according to some estimates. But parents of autistic kids think that the rate may be even higher than that. So if you're the parent of a child with a developmental disability or autism spectrum disorder, what do you do if you find out that your child is being bullied? Do you talk to the teachers? Do you talk to the principals? Do you try to talk to the other parents or the parents of the other kid, the kid who's doing the bullying? Do you try to talk to them and figure out what's going on? Well, the answers are more complicated than just simple yes or no, do this or do that. And in this part of today's show, we're going to be talking with an attorney who specializes in law having to do with developmentally disabled kids. We're going to be talking about how to handle bullying situations and also how to handle more everyday situations about getting the benefits and the services that you're entitled to under the law. It all starts right after this.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this from the MrDad.com radio network.
It's not kids being kids.
It's not about good homes or bad homes.
It's not a normal part of growing up.
I shouldn't be afraid to get on the school bus.
To turn on my computer.
Message. From lock to my locker.
Did you know that a bully will stop his or her behavior in 10 seconds when their peers speak up?
Use your voice.
Hey, leave him alone.
We have the power to stop bullying.
Find out more at bullying.org.
Where you're not alone.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is Gary Mayerson, who is an attorney with Mayerson & Associates, and the firm represents individuals with autism and other developmental disabilities. Gary, welcome to Positive Parenting.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So I want to have you set the stage just a little bit for us. I think a question that immediately comes up or came up for me when I first was talking to Rob, who helped connect us. Why do people with developmental disabilities and autism need a specialized attorney for that? What are their issues?
There are so many reasons why somebody may have to call us. The primary reason is to obtain full funding or to get an adequate defensible program. That's number one. We also may have situations where somebody's being bullied in school, or we've even had cases where there's been sexual assault. Or there's some other safety issue, but the primary issue is to obtain an effective program.
What do you mean by that? What kind of program?
Well, for an autism program, it depends. It's always going to be individualized for the student, but what if a student needs a 20-hour-a-week ABA program, applied behavior analysis, and the school district might be resistant to 20 hours, or they may be resistant to applied behavior analysis at all? So we have to come in sometimes and basically persuade the school district, or if necessary, bring an impartial hearing before a hearing officer in order to get a directive that they have to pay for the program that the child might need.
Now, are these things always adversarial, or are there school districts out there that are very open to the idea?
I think there are many school districts today, as opposed to 20 years ago, who are much more open to the idea of working things out with parents. And in fact, I wrote a book called How to Compromise with Your School District Without Compromising Your Child, and it's all about that. Some school districts, however, are so large and monolithic that it's very difficult to get an individualized program without a big push from either an advocate or a law firm such as ours.
And you're talking about dealing with public schools where they're generally required to provide some kind of services, right? Or are you
Correct.
Talking about okay, so not this is not an issue for people who have their kids in a specialized private school?
Well, you could be in a specialized private school, and you still may have some issues, but the issues will be a lot more narrow. People who go to private schools generally choose those schools, so they're not normally going to be coming to us and saying that there's a problem in the private school.
Okay. And so for those of us who do not have an autistic child or a child with special needs, at least not this kind of special need that you're talking about, what would a program like this look like, or the behavioral analysis look like? What are the actual needs that these kids
well,
have?
Well, I can give you a range, because every child with autism, people will tell you, are completely different from another child. There's no exact perfect paradigm of what a child with autism looks like or presents like, but a child might be verbal, or a child might be nonverbal and need a lot of speech and language therapy. A child might have a lot of behavioral presentations, self-injurious behaviors or aggressive behaviors, or just simply interfering behaviors that might require a behavioral consultant to come on board. And they may need behavioral therapy on top of that, many, many hours worth. And it runs the gamut, because there are students with autism who ultimately make it to college, although that is, and it's more common today than it was 10 or 20 years ago. So it's a big range of services. It might need, mm-hmm. child might need physical therapy or occupational therapy or vision therapy. There's so many things that a kid with autism might need, but it's highly individualized. And that is really what causes the conflict, because the school districts and the public school systems are not really set up for individualized programming so much as they are for a sort of a something close to a one-size-fits-all approach.
Do you suggest that parents try to work within the system, or would they be better off just going someplace else, or is there someplace else?
No, I think that first you always try to work things out with the school district. It's quite disruptive to the student and their parents if they have to move to another district or to another state, which is sometimes what parents have to do, particularly in states. We get calls all the time from states like Texas or Louisiana, and sometimes the answer is you probably do have to move, but we always counsel parents to try to work things out with the school district. If you can stand and you can keep your community connections, your children have friends in the community, and that why have the disruption if you can work things out? Of course, that's the way to go.
And how does this affect the parents? Is I think something that I've always wondered. I mean, we have a tendency you look and you see other people's children, or you see autistic children or children with special needs, and you know, some people would say, "Boy, that's you know, seems like a terrible situation that child is in," but we don't really think about the effect that this is having on the parents and their lives and their emotional state. You're probably dealing with people at a fairly low point in their lives.
There's no question. There's a very high divorce rate recognized among parents with disabilities, and particularly parents of children with autism. For obvious reasons, there's tremendous stress level. So we try to reduce the parents' level of stress by at least taking off their shoulders the job of fighting not only the autism, but fighting with their school district when that becomes a problem.
You know, I'm curious now that they just mentioned this. All of a sudden, it brought up a whole other thing. We're talking about providing services and the various programs. That was the first thing you started off with, about why somebody would need an advocate such as yourself. But are there programs within the school districts for parents themselves about how to handle stress, how to deal with that?
Absolutely. In fact, in New York State, it's required to be on your child's individualized education plan a program of parent training and counseling. So if a parent, and many parents do need this service, needs to know how to work with my child with, let's say, with interfering or aggressive behaviors, or how do I integrate my child into some kind of mainstream outside of school program, or toileting issues? Oh, it could be so many different things.
Those programs are talking to the parents about how you can do this outside of school.
Right.
Okay.
But the parent training and counseling, it really depends, because the New York State law, for example, provides for parent training and counseling to be on the IEP. That's theoretical, because the reality is that in New York City, the parent training and counseling is often inadequate, or the person who's providing it doesn't really know that much about the family, their ecology, or what's going on with the child's individual needs to be really much of any help. So the theoretical right is there, but often that right doesn't translate into actual effective services, which is another reason why we get called in.
Yeah. Now, do you find that parents know what they're entitled to, what their rights are under the various laws? And I'm sure that, again, as you're saying, it's a, laws are different in every state.
I think that unfortunately, even the most intelligent parents, the most educated parents, parents with MBAs, PhDs, all kinds of degrees, including other lawyers, don't really know that much about their rights under IDEA, which is the Educational Act, or the ADA. These are the things they don't teach you in law school. And I think that parents walk around in the main not knowing what their rights are. And so part of at least half of our job is explaining to parents what are those rights and whether they need to access those rights to have an effective program.
How did you get into this?
Well, I have a family member with autism, and I was a partner in a mid-sized firm in Manhattan, and life completely changed at that moment, and that's how I first broke into the field. This is probably close to 20 years ago.
I mean, there are various specialties. You just touched on this. I mean, there's a matrimonial law specialty, there's tax law, there's various things that people can get certified in. Is there not one for disability law of this kind?
In fact, funny you should ask, because the American Bar Association does not yet recognize special education law as its own practice specialty. Usually they throw it under elder law or something like that, but it really has been growing so exponentially over the last 20 years, it completely deserves its own practice specialty. But meanwhile, until the American Bar Association figures out that there is this specialty out there, firms like ours will continue to do what we do, which is representing people with autism and other developmental disabilities. What I'm saying is the specialty exists in reality, but law firms can't claim to be specializing in this because it's of the American Bar Association.
Well, you'd think. I mean, just looking at your website, there's a page, well, I want to call it a page, but if you were to print it out, it probably would be five pages, of court cases and important statutes and things like that. I mean, and I'm sure that just scratches the surface.
Exactly. So it's a reality that the Bar Association has not yet grappled with. And I'm confident that they will eventually. They'll figure it out.
Talking with Gary Mayerson, who is with Mayerson & Associates, which is a law firm that represents individuals with autism and other developmental disabilities. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to keep talking to Gary, get a little bit further into what the issues are that parents are going to be facing and how they can access the right things. And I also want to talk a lot about bullying. And I'm Armin Brott. You're listening to Positive Parenting.
Driving has a rhythm all its own. Don't wreck it with a text. Before you get behind the wheel, silence your phone. Or better yet, designate a texter. For more text-free driving tips, visit stoptextstoprex.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. If you're just joining us, I'm Armin Brott, and talking with Gary Mayerson, who's the main partner of Mayerson & Associates, which is a law firm that represents individuals with autism and other developmental disabilities. So you, on the site, you talk about individuals. Are you talking, do you mostly represent children and parents or adults as well?
Well, we started out, we were representing toddlers and near infants. That was how the practice started out almost 20 years ago. But we followed that population through the age span. And now I would say the bulk of our clients are between the ages of 3 and 17 or 18. But we've had a number of individuals, adults with autism, who have needed our services for something like, let's say, job discrimination, or some other discrimination going on in their lives, and we've had to step in and save the day.
I hate to even go there, but how do you get paid for this? Are you getting paid by the school district? Do you have to sue them and then recover damages that way, or parents are paying for your services?
It depends. We have some parents that pay us by the hour. We've had other parents who don't pay a thing because we take them on a pro bono basis, and we've got probably have at least a dozen pro bono cases this year. And then we have other cases where there's a sort of a mixed hybrid kind of payment situation where we get paid somewhat by the parents, but we also then look to the school district, assuming that we win the case. The school district is then liable to pay the reasonable fees, which are then set by the court. So there's a variety of different ways that we can be paid. And on the other cases, we elect not to be paid because we take the case for free just because it's the right thing to do.
Right. It sounds like there's a lot of challenges being a lawyer in this particular field. It can't be easy. I mean,
No, it's not easy, but the nice thing is that you can sleep at night. I mean, I think that what everyone in my office feels when they come into work is that they feel very fulfilled doing their job, and they enjoy it, and they can go home at night, and like I said, they can sleep at night.
You know, I mentioned bullying, and that's something that I've talked to a number of people who have written books about autism, and including some people who are autistic and have written books, and bullying is something that comes up a lot. Kids are unkind to each other general level, but when you hit something with autism or a developmental disability where there's a visible difference, just that much easier to latch onto.
Well, first of all, when we're talking about bullying in the legal sense, we're talking about something a lot more virulent than simply being unkind to another student. This is when it really gets to be physical or psychological abuse. And when you're talking about the autism population, this is a population that probably is victimized by bullying probably 3 to 4 times more than a typically developing student. And why is that? Because they make really very good victims.
Good targets, yeah.
They really do. So we brought a case about 9 years ago before bullying really was on the landscape. And this is at a time when people were thinking of bullying as some kind of inevitable rite of passage. And we brought a case involving someone who at the time was a third-grade student in a public school environment here in New York City. And just last year, the Federal Second Circuit Court of Appeals basically held for the parent. This is after 8 years when the student was graduating from high school and found that there was a right to be free from psychological or physical abuse. And it's now a landmark case. We're very proud of that decision. It's going to help, I think, thousands of kids across the country.
Did that help that particular kid, though?
Except
for a sense of vindication
afterwards?
Only gets
for the parent afterwards? To get the cost of the private school that the parent had to send their child to after the school district refused to even discuss bullying. And that was one of the central components of the case, was that while the parent had repeatedly attempted to bring up bullying over and over again to meetings with the principal, the administration of the school, this is PS6 right in Manhattan, said, we're not going to discuss it. We will not discuss bullying with you. So the parents had no choice, because the bullying was never going to be addressed or fixed, but to remove their child from the public school system and go private.
How long ago was this?
Well, the year in question was about the 2008-2009 school year, and 2016, in the very beginning of the year, is when the Second Circuit came down with their decision. So it's a pretty awful timeline. But this was a family, this was a parent who refused to give up.
Wow.
And knew that they were right. We felt that they were right, and ultimately the court found that we were.
Well, I'm asking because, I mean, I'm just thinking back to when my kids were in school, and my youngest one is still in school, but you know, I remember going through the halls, and the halls are just completely covered with zero tolerance for bullies policies and don't be a bystander. And this is, you know, certainly during that time period of 2008, everybody's aware of it. I mean, how could a school say we're not going to talk about it?
You should only know. This particular school had a zero tolerance policy, at least in writing. It was on a piece of paper, but it meant nothing. It meant nothing because when the parents went to talk to the principal about the bullying, they were told to get out of my office or I'm calling the police. They went at the IEP meeting to talk about bullying. They were told this is neither the place nor the time. And there were other situations where the parent attempted to discuss the bullying. They were, as the court said, they were stonewalled by the school system. So you can have a theoretical right against bullying. We're not going to accept it. It's zero tolerance. It means nothing. I should point out that the this particular this particular principal was asked about the incident reports. There were a dozen incident reports involving the student. And when we examined the principal at her deposition, this is a public school principal, actually referred to the incident reports as the, I'm not going to say it on your show, the effing incident reports. I'm not kidding. It's in the record. Now,
wow.
What kind of principal would have that kind of disrespect for the system and the parents? I mean, then you know you're really in bad shape. This is why parents sometimes have to go to court.
Yeah,
because they meet a brick wall, such as this.
Was this specific? Was this specific to an autistic child being bullied, or just is that the attitude about all?
It was bullying? Actually, it was a student who originally was diagnosed with autism, who then was reclassified as being learning disabled. That was the actual history of this particular child.
But, I mean, if it would have just been a, I don't want to say normal, but a child without disabilities, would that attitude about bullying have been the same, or was it only because this child had some additional needs?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, but one would think that the principal would even be more sensitive to the student that had the special needs than the student that didn't.
You'd think.
Yeah. So... they really bent over backwards to stonewall the parents. And when I say stonewall,
yeah.
It's not a word. This is not hyperbole. This is a word that the court system used in their decision to talk about the evil that the school district visited upon this family.
So, what do you suggest, or what do you advise parents who have an autistic child or a child with a learning disability or a developmental disability who is being bullied?
Well,
what do they do? How do they handle this?
If you suspect that your child is being bullied, there's so many things that you can and should do. First of all, you do need to get those incident reports if there are any. The first thing I would do if I were a parent and I was in that situation was call a meeting with the principal, the teachers, people who should know better, and to talk about what are they going to do about it. So you probably may need a bullying plan as part of your IEP. Now, the bullying plan can't be just simply that your child, the child that's being victimized, gets to go to counseling to make them feel better about the victimization. The real thing that you're trying to do is to get the school district to focus on who's committing the bullying, to be honest about it, and to talk to their parents and make sure that they either they change their ways or they're removed from the environment. I mean, there's just sometimes the perpetrators have to be removed from the classroom or even sometimes from the school itself. Early intervention is key. The worst thing a parent can possibly do is to kind of wait and pray that maybe things are going to get better and just maybe it'll go away, because it never does.
It never does.
It always gets worse.
That just seems like such a difficult thing to advocate for a child, because you're not, you know, there seems like there's an additional layer. You're not just trying to get something for the child. As you said, you're trying to get somebody else to behave better, which seems like, you can't legislate good behavior, right?
You can't. But you know what sometimes you can do is you can enlist bystanders. Like perhaps there's another student in the classroom, particularly if the other student is a cool person. If the cool person in the classroom points out the bullying and basically communicates in the presence of everyone that bullying is not cool, the bullying often comes to an end. It's when bystanders do nothing and allow it to happen and snicker and just sort of look down at their pens and their paper that bullying continues. I mean, someone has to out the bullying as uncool. And it starts from the top. So obviously if the administrators and teachers do that, that's one level. But the highest level of resistance to bullying is when the students themselves ostracize the bully for being a bully.
Talking with Gary Mayerson, who's with Mayerson and Associates, which is a law firm that represents individuals, children, parents with autism and other developmental disabilities. And the website is Mayer's Law, M-A-Y-E-R-S, law, all one word, .com. Gary, thanks very much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I'm in almost every school bus and classroom. You see me around the neighborhood, and you tell me that I'm a pretty good kid.
Well, I'm one out of every 5 children in America, and I'm struggling with hunger.
Please visit feedingamerica.org today and find your local food bank for ways to help.
Every dollar you donate helps provide 8 meals for kids like me.
We are Feeding America, brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Hey there, welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and it's time for an Ask Mr. Dad segment. Dear Mr. Dad, I'm in my early 70s now and just retired. I put in long hours and did a lot of travel when I was working, so I wasn't around for my son and daughter as much as I wish I could have been. But now that I'm a grandfather, I don't want to miss an opportunity to build strong relationships with my grandkids. The problem is, I don't know how. Where do I start? Well, with today's fathers taking on a much more active role in their kids' lives, you may be part of the last generation that has to ask this excellent and kind of sad question. There's no going back, of course, but building close relationships with your grandchildren is the next best thing. Fortunately, there are plenty of ways to do that. Keep in touch. Call, email, Skype, text, write, and if the kids are old enough, follow each other on social media. If you don't know how, chances are they'll be able to get you set up. Bite your tongue. One of the best parts of the grandparent-grandchild relationship is that you get to skip over the natural conflicts that come up between parents and children. There's a difference between fatherly advice and grandfatherly advice. Make the right choice. Stalk them in a good way. If possible, be there for the kids' recitals, grandparents' days, at school, and other special events. If you can't be there, at least call and ask how things went. Do it all. Take the kids to museums and concerts, teach them how to change a tire, read books, and tell them scary stories about the dark, dark times before we had touch screens. Ask a lot of questions. What are the kids interested in? What are their favorite bands and artists? What blogs do they read? And what is their favorite YouTube channel? At the least, you'll get a crash course in pop culture, plus you'll always know exactly what to get for birthdays and holidays. Get to know their friends. What are their names, and why do your grandchildren like them in the first place? Supporting their friendships shows your grandkids that you care about everything in their life. Don't be a Disneyland grandpa. Disneyland dad, or mom for that matter, typically refers to non-custodial parents who go crazy trying to make their limited time with their kids fun. Grandparents often fall into the same trap, spoiling the kids rotten, chucking discipline out the window, and treating the kids like visiting royalty instead of ordinary human beings. Focus on making their time with you as normal as possible. Naturally, you're going to indulge them a little. Hey, that's what grandparents do, isn't it? But take it easy. Develop some thick skin. Most teens and tweens go through an I hate everything and everyone phase and may push you away. Don't take it personally. Just let them know you're there for them and that they'll always have a non-judgmental, safe place to hang out if they need one. Stay out of the middle. Never, ever take sides in an argument between your grandchildren and their parents. Keep a lid on the fatherly advice. Of course, you have your children's best interest at heart, and you want to make sure they're happy in every area of their life. But unless they specifically ask for your opinions, keep them to yourself, especially the ones about how your child married a moron. It's okay to clip out one of these columns or have your kids listen to one of these segments, but watch out for their reaction and respond accordingly. If you've got a question or a comment for us here at Positive Parenting, please drop us a line. You can do that through the website, MrDad.com or AskMrDad.com, where you can also find tons of archives of our previous segments and columns. We'll be back next week with another segment for you. Hey, but you know what? You know this already. There's a lot more Positive Parenting coming right up, so stay right where you are.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this. From the MrDad.com radio network.
Son, we got to talk about drinking.
I know.
I don't want you touching alcohol till you're old enough.
Yeah, I know, Dad. It's not a big deal.
Don't yeah, I know me, okay? And it is a big deal. Underage drinking is just stupid.
Yeah, well, why'd you do it?
Look, I did it because we didn't know what we know now. Alcohol affects kids differently, okay? When kids drink, it's more dangerous. And you're my kid. And just because they drink doesn't mean you have to.
I know.
Look, son, I'm trying to help. I've seen what it does. I mean, you may think you can handle it, but when you drink, it screws up your judgment. Listen to me. This is real.
I know, okay?
Teenagers know everything. So talk about underage drinking before they know it all. Before they're teens. Start talking before they start drinking. And keep talking. To learn more about the dangers of underage drinking and what to say to your kids, go to stopalcoholabuse.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Now, get ready for more positive parenting with Armin Brott from the MrDad.com radio network.
Hello and welcome to the second part of today's Positive Parenting Show. I'm Armin Brott. College drinking, including extreme heavy drinking, has been a tradition since the 19th century. Because of this, it can be hard to convince middle-aged people that something has changed, but the consistent, sometimes it's urgent and sometimes it's resigned, report from college officials is that something has gone terribly awry, and huge numbers of students regularly transform the American campus into like a college-themed spin-off of The Walking Dead. They vomit endlessly, they destroy property, they become the victims or perpetrators of sexual events ranging from the unpleasant to the criminal. They get rushed off in ambulances and join the ever-growing waiting list for counseling. Depression and anxiety go hand in hand with the heavy drinking, and both are at epidemic proportions on campuses. Some people put the blame on what they call the 21 law, which they say drove drinking on college campuses underground. But the truth is a little bit more complex than that, because overall, drinking rates on campus have gone down since that law was passed in 1984, as they have with 18 to 21-year-olds who are not in campus. But here's the thing. What's going on is that kids have switched from just generally heavy drinking to binge drinking, having more than 10 drinks in a night, and searching not just for a little bit of drunkenness, but for complete passing out. We'll talk about the epidemic of college binge drinking when Positive Parenting continues right after this.
My name's Tyler, and in 9 years, I'll be an alcoholic. I'll start drinking in middle school, just at parties. But my parents won't start talking to me about it till high school.
Kids who drink before age 15 are 5 times more likely to have alcohol problems when they're adults.
Thing is, my parents won't even see it coming.
So start talking before they start drinking. To learn more, go to stopalcoholabuse.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the Ad Council, and this station.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is Caitlin Flanagan, who's the author of a new article in the Atlantic Monthly magazine called How Helicopter Parenting Can Cause Binge Drinking. Caitlin, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's an intriguing, certainly eye-opening title. Talk about where that concept came from.
Well, you know, it is an intriguing title. I don't think it's a completely accurate title. I take a little credit for it. I certainly read the title before it went out, but didn't think about it too much. I'm really describing within the category of helicopter parents, and I'm certainly one. I know it's a pejorative concept, but the idea of parents who are very attentive and possibly too attentive to our children, that once kids get into high school and it's time to think about alcohol use, there are really kind of two different decisions that parents make. One parent will sort of decide, well, we need to be good parents. We need to try to do the very best thing, and we think that should be to work really hard to keep our kids from drinking alcohol at all. And we're going to enforce a family culture that supports that, and we're going to explain that to our children, and we're going to talk a lot about it because we don't think there's anything to be gained from underage drinking. And the other group makes a different decision, and I call them the get real parents. They sort of decide, you know, teenagers are going to drink. That's what kids have done, you know, going back to colonial times, teenagers in America drink alcohol, certainly boys did. And it's ridiculous to try to stop them from doing it. So we are going to get real about it. We're going to let them drink at our house or at the houses of their friends, and we know the parents, where there's some supervision, where an adult will say, no driving, take the car keys, and keep an eye out on them. And so these two groups that are really similar in every other category are making a very different decision about how they're going to handle alcohol with their kids. And this leads ultimately to a lot of friction and feelings of betrayal between the two groups when they realize that some of the closest friends within the parent group have very different decisions and are giving very different messages, and people ultimately feel quite judged about it.
And so I'm guessing that somewhere in the middle is where we need to be, because both of those sound kind of unrealistic, even though the get real sounds like it would be more in line with the way things are. You still have the problem with get real parents is backing off entirely and leaving everything up to the kids.
Right. Well, the problem here is that for this group, this kind of, you know, more affluent group that is definitely going to be sending their children to college, they're sending them to a college environment where binge drinking is very different from the heavy drinking of their own youth at college. You know, 30 years ago, say, at American college campuses, there was plenty of heavy drinking. But it wasn't the kind of drinking that you see now, where kids, you know, very normal-seeming kids who are doing well and seem happy and adjusted, aren't just drinking to get wild or even to get drunk. They're drinking intentionally to get into a blackout, intentionally to be throwing up, intentionally to be passed out. So there's no real way ever to teach a kid how to drink that way. There was an old-fashioned idea when I was young that you had to learn how to drink and how to hold your liquor, and that there might be a trial by fire and you might have a couple of horrible nights, but then you'd learn your limits. And so I think a lot of parents today in the get real style are saying, oh, this is good. They'll learn their limits this way. And when they go to college, they won't get in any trouble. Not realizing that the point of college binge drinking is there aren't any limits. You're supposed to surpass any limits. And so the kid ends up at college, if they've had this kind of supervised heavy drinking at home, with a set of very false beliefs. One of them is that I can handle myself and be safe even when I'm extremely drunk. And that there are all sorts of safety nets around me when I'm extremely drunk. Because, look, I've done it several times or even many times in high school, and nothing bad ever happened to me. So the get real parents have to do a little bit of thinking about what other lessons are you teaching your kid when you allow him or her to drink with friends under some supervision.
Well, let's go back just a little bit to a few generations ago, where you talked about 30 years. That seems like a pretty good place to start. But What happened exactly? How did we get to a point where kids are going to sit down and, I mean, they know that this can't be good for them. You know, they're going to polish off half their weight in alcohol or some horrible amount. You know, and I think we need to actually, before we get there, make a quick definition between heavy drinking and binge drinking. And binge drinking being just drinking a massive amount at one time. You might not do it every day, hopefully.
Well, among researchers, binge drinking, the exact amount that goes into binge drink, binge night or extreme binge drinking is a topic of some fraught discussion. People will have different limits, different amounts of alcohol that they say qualifies a binge or qualifies an extreme binge. But I'm talking about what you see in college campuses where there are parties where, as I say, the goal isn't just to get drunk, it's to get in a blackout. There will be blackout parties. Quite regularly, a lot of colleges. So, but your question is a very apt one. How did this happen and what happened and how did it change? And if you want to start a fight, get together a bunch of college professors or college presidents and a bunch of public health researchers. And the people at college are going to say, it's gotten much worse. They drink much more. And the public health people are going to say, no, they drink less than ever before. And the conversation gets nowhere. That was the most interesting part of the essay to me. That's the most interesting part of the research. And in fact, what's happened is the National Minimum Drinking Age Act, that people think of as the 18 law, which went into effect in 1984, it reduced alcohol consumption in that age group, 18 to 21, across all categories, in college and out of college. There is less drinking in college than there was.
Well, if you measure it in terms of ounces over a lifetime or over a time period, but if you measure it in terms of ounces consumed in a day or in one sitting, it's probably different.
It's actually if you measure it in terms of the actual amount, number of kids who are drinking at all, number of kids who ever binge, number of kids who will drink very, very modestly, the actual amount of consumption over those 4 years is down overall. But in one concentrated group, it's not. It is up, and it's much higher than people even thought before. And who are these? These are the kids who were primed to be college drinkers, and there's a lot of predictive factors. Socioeconomic factors. You know, if you are a white kid whose parents went to college, who is on very little financial aid or no financial aid, if you join a fraternity or sorority, if you play a sport, varsity or intramural, not that any or all of these things mean you're going to be a binge drinker, and not that there aren't plenty of binge drinkers of other races and other, you know, sort of socioeconomic profiles, but those target demographics, that's the core of college drinking since college began, except in sort of middle-class males beyond the ministerial studies in the 19th century. That group has really responded to the 18 law by starting to drink in secret, by starting to think, well, we're not going to be able to drink at the school-sponsored event, so we better drink a whole heck of a lot before we get there. We better have what they call pre-gaming parties. You know, we're going to drink a ton of vodka before we get there because we won't be able to drink until we get back out of there again. And so a whole sort of set of behaviors. We need to drink away from any supervision. We need to drink away from any adults. We need to drink hard liquor as opposed to beer or wine because we need to get this job done very, very efficiently. And that's created a whole culture for that group of kids. And I think that the more we can be aware of that, the more we can start to hack into that culture a little bit. Because to just say all college kids are binge drinkers or all college kids drink very differently, then you'll sit with a set of research that says that's not true, and the conversation kind of founders a little bit.
How much do you think that this has to do with the now famous issues about brain development and teenagers don't, you know, they don't understand their young adults even until they're mid-20s perhaps. Their brains aren't set and they don't understand consequences. I mean, it seems I could understand that you could say to a kid, well, you know, if you drink like this, 20 years from now, your liver is going to get, you know, cancer, you're going to get cirrhosis and you're going to die. And I could say, okay, a kid is not going to understand completely that 20 years, you know, that's never going to happen. But you could say, you know, you're going to die tonight if you do that. You're going to drink yourself and you know, you're going to black out and you will not wake up, or there's a chance of that. Is there an issue of not understanding consequences?
It's interesting. The issue of brain development is, I think, how this is ultimately going to be resolved, because I was so interested in how many parents who care so much about the brain and the intellectual and academic life of their kids and who work really hard to get them extra tutoring and to make sure they go into the best possible colleges and all of that will suddenly abandon that whole project with alcohol and let them drink as much alcohol as they, you know, want to on the weekend. And I thought, why are these parents who care so much about academic success and intellectual life of their kids, why are they letting them wash their brains through with booze like this on a regular level? It's the worst thing you can possibly do to a developing brain. And I think that the next generation of parents coming up, they're looking at all this new research about plasticity, of neuroplasticity, and about the fact that the brain isn't really sort of developed until the early 20s and
right,
possibly the mid-20s. And I think this next generation is going to start to say, you know what, we need to be parent differently around this.
Let me stop you there. We got to take a quick break. With Caitlin Flanagan, who's the author of How Helicopter Parenting Can Cause Binge Drinking. That's an article in The Atlantic magazine. We've got a link to it on the website. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll keep talking to Caitlin.
When I have an asthma attack, I feel scared. It's kind of like an elephant is on my chest.
I feel like I'm choking.
Sometimes my parents have to take me to the hospital.
You know how to react to their asthma attacks. Here's how to prevent them. Call 1-866-NO-ATTACKS. Visit www.noattacks.org or call your doctor. Because even one attack is one too many.
I feel like a fish with no water.
Brought to you by the EPA and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. If you're just joining us, talking with Caitlin Flanagan, who's the author of an article in The Atlantic magazine called How Helicopter Parenting Can Cause Binge Drinking. Just before the break, we were talking about the parents becoming aware of new research about the brain and how kids are not quite up to snuff as like adults are, although plenty of adults don't understand consequences either. but that this is being contributed to by parents who are not quite clear on the concept. Keep going on that.
Well, I think that today's parent of a teenager is sort of looking at all this new research saying, oh, no, what am I going to do? It's too late. I've already kind of created this drinking culture for my child. My child's already in college. It's probably too late to really take advantage of that learning and change the way parents think. But I think that we've seen parents make profound changes around children's safety. Look at, you know, nobody had a bike helmet when I was growing up. Nobody had shin guards when I was growing up. We all laugh at ourselves for being so careful about our children and safety. But then so many parents give up altogether when it comes to alcohol, which is probably going to pose a more real threat to developing brains than many of the things we take care to avoid in terms of physical safety to the kid and to the brain. As far as the risk of sort of drinking themselves to death, you know, as horrifying as that is, it's actually pretty rare for that to happen. And kids know that. You know, the kids are old enough now that we can't kind of con them into something and terrify them with something that they know isn't going to happen. But I think that alcohol is deeply implicated in the two biggest crises on college campuses today, sexual assault and mental health problems. If you go and tour any college in America today, those are the two things that administrators are going to be talking about and saying, we don't really know what to do. You know, when you're that drunk, you're more likely to commit a crime, you're more likely to be the victim of a crime. And, you know, America is now rightly looking at college forced sex as being not, you know, a date gone bad. It's looking at it as a criminal event, or certainly as a disciplinary event that can get the young man thrown out and have severe long-term consequences for the young woman. And then the whole tide of mental health problems on campus, I'm not saying they're caused by binge drinking, but talk to anybody who's a counselor on a college campus and ask if alcohol plays any role in some of the depression and anxiety that she's seen. She'll say, yes, it plays a huge role. So I think that in some of these more invisible, a little bit harder to grasp consequences, that parents can unintentionally be setting themselves up for very hard, difficult life experiences that their children can have in college. You know, they look at the more severe outcomes, well, it is unlikely that you're going to die of alcohol poisoning. It is unlikely that something really dire on that level is going to happen. But these other softer, if you will, complications are, I prefer, a little more invisible, linked connections are things I think parents really want to think about as they head into adolescence with their kids at home.
Well, we've been talking about what you've named the get real parents, and I want to go back a little bit to the good parents, I mean, in quotes, who mm-hmm. say, don't do it at all, it's terrible, you should never do it. And that approach, I think we all know as parents, you know, anybody who sent a kid off to college or had a high schooler for that matter, saying things like that produces zero results for the most part, right? I mean, kids, you can't just threaten kids.
Are pretty consistent that just a zero tolerance approach from parents without any connection to something larger within the life of the family, be it a religious practice, be it a set of sort of principles and morals that the family has really ascribed to over the years, be it some family member who's come into a terrible tragedy through alcohol or has been lost to alcohol, just sort of saying zero tolerance and being inflexible about it. There are kids it works for. There are kids who are very rule-bound kids and kids with really high degrees of self-control and who won't respond that way, you know, who won't drink. They are often, very sadly, the kids who do get to college and the first night just go absolutely wild and are in terrible trouble in the first week. So there can be bad consequences even for just the child who does follow that through high school and cuts loose in college. But here's the interesting thing. There are lots and lots of kids on college who abstain, and researchers ask them all the time, well, why do you abstain? And the first answer is, my parents disapprove, and the second answer is the related answer, my religion forbids it. So parents, I think, often feel that the culture is stronger than the parents. Parents are very strong right now in their kids' lives, very strong. And kids do listen to parents. It's not, if you want to raise a kid who doesn't drink or who drinks lightly, it's not going to be a set it and forget it kind of enterprise. It's going to require a lot of work on the parents' part, a lot of commitment. And the number one thing I said in any interview around this is, no matter what your policy on alcohol is with a kid, it always has to have the following escape clause. However, if some night you make a mistake and you get too drunk, I will never punish you if you call me and ask for a ride home or if you get a taxi or an Uber home. That's absolutely a get-out-of-free-jail card. I won't punish you because you never want to have a kid who thinks, oh, I'm going to be in terrible trouble and they'll know I've done it and I don't want to disappoint them and I don't want to lower myself in their eyes. I'll just one eye at home. Because the one thing we have to keep preventing is kids getting behind the wheel, because that is
right.
Something that leads to tragedy.
Well, that's a little bit of a different situation than sending a kid off to a college who's in a different state or more than a taxi ride or Uber ride home. Do those mm-hmm. messages last as well over distance?
Yeah, as I say, the largest growing group in college actually are the abstainers, altogether abstainers. You know, kids make all kinds of decisions for themselves, and I think when we get locked into the kid's going to be a heavy drinker and the kid's going to be a binge drinker, we are accurate in that we're locking into certain cultural expectations. All cultures have traditions. All cultures have heritages. You know, I went to college. My father, my grandfather, my mother, everybody went to college in the family. Everybody drank when they were in college. I'm white, middle class. They're white and middle class. There's a long, strong culture of white middle-class people drinking heavily in college, and what that has to do with is that college isn't the make or break for us. We can afford to take it very, very lightly. We have safety net upon safety net upon safety net, and if we drink too much and we miss a class and we miss another class and our paper's late, we have a lot of skills and savvy in terms of how to talk to a professor about that, how to call a parent for help, how to use resources on campus. I've known friends of mine who certainly, when a kid's really behind academically for whatever reason, have flown to the college and helped them get back on track. If you are a kid who's a first-generation college on a full scholarship, you're not there to have a good time. You're there to change your life trajectory and maybe even the trajectory of your family. And they don't have that kind of luxury, and they are much more likely not to drink at all. They look at college as substantively different. And so I think those of us who are sending kids from a college tradition of that's what you do is drink, is we need to think about, should we think about changing our cultural expectations of this generation we're raising? It's not easy. Is it possible? I would say it probably is, but it's been huge. You know, getting people to wear seatbelts and not drink when they drive, people thought could never be done. So I don't think it's impossible, but we are operating out of a culture that we can question. But nobody is at this point.
And how much of this has to do with examples that are being set at home? I mean, there's a certain problem with the do as I say, not as I do. If you come from a family where whoever it is that comes home from work has a couple of martinis every night at 5 o'clock, that's going to be harder to get a message across to the kids than in a family where the parents don't drink.
Well, here's the thing. Kids don't relate wine at dinner or maybe even... It's interesting you say that because like, I really don't know that many people in this day and age who are sort of like, everybody works so hard now. I don't know the two martinis after work as being kind of a big demographic in this group we're talking about. But kids see as two separate behaviors, wine with dinner or a cocktail or two that a parent has and a binge drinking episode at college. They don't even see them as related. So a lot of parents think, well, I'm going to teach my kid to enjoy wine, for example, and to drink in a sophisticated way, or even to have a cocktail. And that will ignore them from binge drinking because they've learned to put alcohol in a reasonable, civilized place in their life. No, that's a good, perhaps useful behavior you've taught them. But this additional behavior of kids saying, let's go to the blackout party, they don't see those as connected. They would do both. They would have one night where they went out with friends and had some fine wine, and the next night they might go out and binge drink. So there really isn't any protective factor at all in teaching them that kind of drinking, and there's not that much of a predictive factor mm-hmm. in witnessing parents saying, yes, you know, you weren't allowed to drive a car when you were 16, and now you can. You're not allowed to drink alcohol until you're 21, and then you can. But all the whole time you've known me, I've been able to drive, and I've been able to drink. So.
Right.
You know, it's on the margins, it's different. If you have an alcoholic parent, all bets are off, and you probably are inculcating that.
Talking with Caitlin Flanagan, who's the author of How Helicopter Parenting Can Cause Binge Drinking. It's in the Atlantic magazine. We've got a link to it on the website. Caitlin, thanks very much.
You're so welcome.
Thanks for listening to Positive Parenting. You can get more information on today's show and what we're working on in the weeks ahead at MrDad.com. While you're there, visit the MrDad.com gift shop with everything you need to help you become the dad or mom you want to be. Positive Parenting is a production of the MrDad.com radio network. Now, go be a great parent.